The meeting of the House Special Committee on Military and Veterans Affairs will come to order. It is now 1:07 p.m. on Tuesday, February, I believe it's the 4th, 2014. We're in room 120. Currently, the members present are Representative Higgins, Representative Co-Chair Ledoux, Representative Reinbold, and Representative, Hughes. And so with that, let the record reflect that we do have a quorum to conduct business. Please do turn off cell phones and smartphones. So moving on to business today, we are hearing two bills, HJR 19, which is to base F-35 aircraft at Eielson. And we'll also be hearing HB 212, which is driver's licensing exemption. So with that, here to speak about House Joint Resolution 19 is Representative Isaacson. If you could come up and introduce yourself, and for the record, and if you have staff as well, please introduce yourself. And with that, appreciate you coming. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Doug Isaacson, and I represent the great communities of North Pole and Eielson Air Force Base, all the way down to the Little Salt River. And so this is definitely in our district. I'd like to introduce beside me my intern from UAA, Nathan Solario, and he's a major in political science and has helped me out with this and will help me out with the presentation, I believe, if I don't do it right.
And for the record, Representative Sadler has joined us. Thank you, Representative. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity of bringing forward this resolution for your consideration. The words, if I could read this, if we would provide an adequate defense for the United States, we must have Alaska to dominate the North Pacific, were words that were said over 100 years ago by then Secretary of State William Seward to Congress. His words are still true today. Since the beginning, our state has been very strategic for military activity and very important part of our national security. Military activity has been a very large part of the economic growth of Alaska. It is one of the top job producers today in our economy. And I come before you today to ask for your vote in keeping Alaska at the forefront of our nation's economic and military sectors by passing this resolution. My staff has prepared these notes, so I have to read them. The Pacific Air Forces are looking to station F-35 aircraft somewhere in the Asia-Pacific theater. Eielson is in tough competition with some international bases in order to become the home for the new aircraft. And as a matter of fact, we're in an extremely short timetable because the base site, the siting decision team, will be coming to Eielson, it looks like, later this month in February. And HDR 19 is another one of our efforts in the legislature to strongly encourage the military to expand the mission of Eielson Air Force Base. Last year, we were very strategic in the decision by the military to reverse its idea of changing where the F-16s would be located. That was a statewide initiative. In the same way, we need a statewide support for basing F-35s. One of the questions that come up is, well, why not at J-Bear, since J-Bear might be losing some? This will actually help support the mission of J-Bear. F-22s and F-35s will not be stationed in the same place, and General Carlisle said that last year, and that's still their decision. But because the F-22s are in J-Bear, it makes it very viable to have the F-35s in Eielson because of the proximity of the joint exercise operations that they have. F-35s and F-22s are both fifth-generation aircraft. F-16s are fourth-generation aircraft. To let you see the difference between this, after my comments, we'll put up a presentation that the military provided to let us know what a fifth-generation aircraft is. Right now, three most recent military sites that have been awarded F-35 squadrons have had tremendous support from both their government, and their citizens. Those three bases are Hill Air Force Base in Utah, Burlington Airport National Guard in Vermont, and recently Luke Air Force Base in Arizona. ISN's strengths are now recognized on a consistent basis by our armed forces. We have minimal airspace congestion throughout Alaska. We have proximity to the Asia Pacific and to the F-22s at J-Bear. We have free access to training environment, including J-Park, the nation's largest restricted training airspace. We have runway with year-round handling for any type of aircraft at ISN. We have storage capacity for over 20 million gallons of gas with a direct pipeline to our refineries in North Pole, unlike any other Air Force station. ISN Air Force Base is also more cost-effective to maintain than other overseas Pacific installations, and it's going to be a big component to our local and regional economies. So I respectfully ask you to give your full support. Join Alaskans and military members and pass this resolution out of committee. What I do need to say is, from my standpoint, So with your permission, I would like to show a 10-minute clip introducing fifth-generation F-35 aircraft. You will be the first ones in the legislature to see this.
Great. Okay. Well, we'll go ahead and let's see the video first, and then we'll take questions. So.
Thank you, sir.
And can we douse lights on the
mic? Thanks. Can you hear this?
No. Quicker speed. Deliver greater air-to-ground capabilities. And provide the United States and allied nations with air dominance. The evolving aircraft match the evolving...
And we will pause this while we figure out our volume.
Okay, is this... Yeah,
this is still working.
Threat until now.
All right, hold on a second.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Technical glitches, which will not happen with these aircraft, I can assure you.
Just to a quick question. Since we're waiting, just to let people know, you know, being in the 168th for 11 years and the tanker unit out of Ileson, which is there, which is also a good pawn in this
yes.
whole game.
Yes.
But the way the aircraft are numbered when you go F-14s, F-15s, F-16s is this. The bottom line is the F-15, F-16 was the plane they finally picked after, and each plane that they work on, they number. And so the 16 was the final product after the 15 that we're working. So like you were saying, this airplane right here is, they have an F-34, believe it or not, that didn't quite, you know, they had to tweak it a little bit to get the F-35. And that's why you see these numbers. Somebody asked me that a long time ago. I was like, well, why do we have these numbers? Well, believe it or not, there's an F-1 that started off with number one. We ended up at an F-16. So that's the same way with us. They just keep evolving it.
So are through the chair?
Representative Lady.
So are there F-2s, 3s, 4s, 5s, the whole
There are. There's a whole game. I'm sorry. I don't want to take over for you. But yeah, they are. But they're not flyable. They're just on paper. Some of them are on paper. You know, but every time they tweak it, exactly. Some of them
is the Phantom.
That's right. The F-4 is a Phantom. You're exactly right. You know, some of them fly, some of them don't. But it's usually the end product that they decide to stop on that they're flying.
Okay.
And that's the way it works.
Thank
it's kind of cool, actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
Representative Hughes?
And since we're having a little 101 here, is it correct to assume that the F is for fighter and a C, like in a C-130, would be cargo? Is that correct?
We can assume that. I'm not sure. I'm not going to put that on record.
Through the chair, yes, Representative Hughes. And R would be for reconnaissance and things like that. So you hear an RC, it's a reconnaissance off of a cargo platform, and say 135, et cetera. And that's what I was in when I was in the Air Force.
Yeah.
With your permission, Mr. Chair, we are ready to begin.
Please proceed.
Thank you.
Well, we thought we were ready.
Air dominance. The evolving aircraft match the evolving threat. Until now. New threats are emerging. The enemy is making gains in technology.
Can you hear that?
What will it take to maintain our dominance?
Okay.
Fifth generation F-35 Lightning.
1 second. Is there a way to make that?
That part we have to do.
I don't know if you can hear this or not. Mr. Chair, is the committee able to hear?
We can hear it. If we're
okay.
Quiet.
Well, I think we'll get visual anyway. All right.
Designed for the most hostile combat environments, it can handle advanced air and surface threats. It can support troops on the ground. It can make your current fighter fleet more effective. It does this by combining 5 key attributes.
Let me pause it just for a half second.
The VLOs.
I think there might be another way to get this sound going higher. Okay. Is there? Do you need a light?
Are you using an HDMI cable? Is that what you're hooked into?
It's in an RGB.
Yeah.
Because you have to tell the computer where you want the sound to go through. You have to go to settings, sound, and let the computer know you want to send it through that.
I don't know what they have set up for the sound system.
Or whatever cable it is.
Okay, so where are we going now? Let me see.
Key attributes. Cool.
Back on
the VLO stealth technology, the F-35, is truly a game-changing technology. It allows the F-35 pilot to operate in places we've never operated before. It can do things with a fighter aircraft that we've never even thought of before. That truly is game-changing.
From the smallest rivet to the high-thrust engine, everything on the fifth-generation fighter is built from the ground up to be virtually invisible to enemy radar. Stealth has to be designed in from the beginning, the shape of the airplane and its coatings, to have a signature where you're able to see without being seen is the fighter pilot's dream. When the threat engagement envelopes for fourth generation aircraft are plotted on a map, and the F-35 with its stealthy signature is introduced, those threat engagement envelopes shrink to the point where the F-35 has corridors that it can access deep into enemy territory.
F-35 VLO technology allows us, the fighter pilots, to decide when and where we want to engage. When the enemy can't see us and we can see him. When we can shoot the enemy before he can see us. And when we can have missile impact on the enemy before he even knows we're there. That's the game-changing technology of F-35.
The stealth protecting the F-35 means that it can better protect ground troops and keep them safe.
Fighter performance obviously is crucial to how we employ an airplane. We bring to the game capabilities that other aircraft don't have. That is, one, to enter the fight unseen, take advantage of a positional advantage that other aircraft never had, and to employ weapons from that positional advantage well in advance of the fighter aircraft we're fighting against, even maneuvering against us. In a legacy mindset, you had to have an aircraft that could turn to put a sensors in an environment in which you could employ a weapon. The F-35, with its helimetic cueing system and all foresight weapons, can take advantage of other aircraft without having to maneuver, yet it still possesses the same, if not better, fighter performance.
The angle of attack takes us past the stall point of the airplane. And this airplane, once you get past that stall angle of attack, you can still move the nose around, up and down and side to side, and maneuver to get where you want to be in relation to your opponent. So it'll be a, maneuver enhancing capability that the F-35 has that perhaps gives it the advantage to any adversary it might encounter. Not only that, it gives high confidence to the pilot flying the F-35 that he can do about whatever he wants to with the airplane, take it to the edge of its envelope, and not be afraid of departing control flight, and not be afraid of getting control back if he does.
The F-35's fighter performance, total situational awareness, and VLO stealth allow it to fly close to the border, identify approaching enemy aircraft, and defeat those enemy aircraft long before they ever cross the border. In a high-threat battle space, the F-35's VLO stealth gives it a clear advantage when employing an assortment of internally carried advanced weapons. In a low-threat environment, the F-35 maintains the advantage with its capability to deliver a variety of weapons in great quantities. The fighter's speed and agility is matched with cutting-edge technology that allows the pilot to see in every possible direction. These sensors track air or ground targets with or without emitting. The data the F-35 gathers is combined into a clear and accurate picture for the pilot. That's integrated sensor fusion.
The integrated sensor fusion of the F-35 brings together information from all my sensors, both onboard and offboard, and presents them to the pilot in such a way that is intuitive, easy to use, and easy to assimilate. Now, the pilot of the F-35 is able to make the right decision at the right time in the battle space in a very intuitive manner. You don't have to be a technician and operate individual sensors. We can be the ultimate tactician.
A fifth-generation fighter can quickly get detailed information from multiple sources around the globe, from surface vessels, from other planes in the sky, from satellites, from the ground, and from state-of-the-art sensors on the F-35 itself.
So the pilot in the F-35 has amazing situational awareness of what's going on around his airplane. And he can share that information with members of his own flight. As a four-ship, an eight-ship, you know, force employment of the F-35, that information is shared around all the aircraft. So those airplanes, the pilots still has the same information as the ace of the base. Now what really separates the F-35 is the ability to take the important nuggets of that information and through other data links outside of the F-35 realm and give that information to other legacy platforms so they themselves can be force enablers, make better decisions themselves. Just as the F-35 was designed to provide pilots with unprecedented situational awareness, so too was it designed for ease of sustainment by the maintainers.
The Leading Edge Autonomic Logistics Information System, or ALIS, is a key element to F-35 sustainment. It is the digital thread that links the global F-35 air system. ALIS is the information technology infrastructure which supports aircraft operations, mission planning, training, aircraft maintenance, the global supply chain, and sustaining engineering. It allows the air system to link all aspects of the global fleet, which increases the speed and accuracy of data exchange, sustainment actions, and flight operations.
What we're seeing is the aircraft's much easier to fly, but as far as I'm concerned, much easier to maintain as well. This aircraft has very much been designed with the maintainer in mind, so all the components that we need to change, the work we have to do, is considerably easier and hence quicker for the maintenance team that we've brought on board.
From defending the homeland to supporting coalition operations, the F-35 can do it all.
The great thing about the F-35 is we're not just an air-to-air and an air-to-ground platform. In the air-to-air realm, this is the best air-to-air fighter this period on the international market. No one comes close to the F-35 in the air dominance arena. We perform a myriad of other tasks and other missions that no other legacy strike fighter could ever perform.
Profound advances in capability, all in an affordable platform that dramatically increases the effectiveness of a nation's air operations for decades to come.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very impressive, Representative Isaacson. Thank you for that. With that, we'll take questions from the committee, and the first one is from co-chair Ledoux, Representative Isaacson. Do you have a comment?
And if I could, just to let you know, there are three community members, Tim Jones, former colonel with VP Dorian Utilities, Jim Dotson with FUDC, and Mayor Lou Copkins are also available if there's any questions. So thank you. Go for testimony.
I don't really have a question, just a comment. That is one beautiful airplane. That is really spectacular.
Through the chair, you are absolutely right, Representative Ledoux, co-chair Ledoux. Thank you.
Representative Hughes.
Yes, and thank you for sharing that footage. It was pretty exciting, exhilarating. I have a couple of questions, Mr. Chairman. And the first one, do we know who we're competing against for the placement of F-35s? Just what other locations? Do you happen to have that information?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, according to General Carlisle, we are looking at bases, Kadena Air Base in Japan, Misawa Air Base in Japan, Kunsan Air Base, South Korea, Osan in South Korea, and there are others, but they're looking at nine bases total. He says we won't put the F-35s in Hawaii because we already have F-22s there, and that's the same application for J-Bear, which is home to two F-22 squadrons. Anderson Air Force Base Guam is not really optimum, although that's being considered. And they said that they won't put it in Yokota because that's where the C-130s are. So that's the information that I have as of today.
I'll follow up. Thank you for that, and I would say that I'm cheering for our location here, first of all, but the proximity to those Asian bases, hopefully that will help us. I have another question, if I may, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned a meeting occurring later this month, and I don't remember what the meeting was called, but is your intention to try to get this passed prior to the meeting? Do you believe that would be helpful? It's some sort of site selection meeting or something happening. Could you elaborate on that and whether the passage of this prior to that date is your goal?
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, Representative Hughes, absolutely. The other body heard a similar resolution today. And so we're in two races, actually. Ultimately, it's to make sure that this is in front of them before the site selection team comes up this month. And it's also to let the other body know that the House is carrying the leadership on this one, because we are. It's a little rivalry in House as well. But definitely the main impact is to let the site selection team know that the state is firmly behind ILSIN's placement.
Okay, and one more follow-up, and they're all kind of not exactly related, so I suppose it's not fair for me to be saying follow-up. The last one is F-35s, are there similar aircraft that are being used by foreign militaries? Do you happen to know?
Through the chair, Representative Hughes, there is no other aircraft like this in the world. They have three models, one for the Air Force, one for the Navy, and one for the Marines. I'm told that other countries have participated in the manufacture, and so they will get a version, but none to the full capacity that I'm aware of, and I do not sit in Congress. We don't know all of the secrets, but from what I'm told as it's represented, this would be a high advantage to the United States.
Thank you.
This aircraft.
For the record, we've got Representative Grunberg, who joined us about 10 minutes ago, and I believe we've got Representative Ledoux.
Yes. Representative Isaacson, it says, I think on line 13, page 2, that they're planned to replace A-10 aircraft. So where are the A-10 located? And forgive me if you've already testified to that.
Through the chair, Representative Co-Chair Ledoux, No, I had not actually mentioned that. The A-10s were something that Eielson lost back in 2005 when it had been on the chopping block before with the BRAC process. A-10s have been phased out of the Air Force's inventory. It was a subsonic infantry support. This aircraft can go supersonic, hypersonic, whatever, and subsonic. As you see, it can hover. It provides all the support functions that the A-10 did, plus functions like the F-16. This is the platform that the Air Force is looking at. Some have said this would be the last fighter aircraft they designed. Well, that's like in the 1950s, IBM CEO said, we only need 5 computers in the whole world. So I think that's a short-sighted statement, but this is how they're looking at it, as this will last for a long time.
Somebody, sort of like follow-up, sort of like somebody coming to the legislature and saying that it's a one-time request.
But actually, could I follow up here? So the A-10s, after they were taken from Elmendorf in, I think you said, 2005, where did they go? And I guess I'm just wondering whether anybody who has the A-10s right now, are they trying to get the F-35s to replace their A-10s?
Through the chair, they left Eielson in 2005, and I think they went to Arizona, but I think perhaps our co-chair of the Joint Armed Services Committee might have the actual location, because I can't recall what happened to our A-10s.
Representative Sadler?
Thank you, Representative Isaacs. Through the chair, Representative Liu, I guess. I think the A-10s have gone a little more forward. I couldn't say what base they've exactly gone to. They're still an awesome anti-tank ground support platform. It'll be a shame to see them go away. But I think they've been more forward deployed, and if they ever get around to building the full build-out of F-35s, they will indeed replace all the A-10s.
Follow-up. I understand that, but I'm just trying to figure out if the A-10s mostly are in any specific place that might say that, hey, you're taking our A-10s away, you're phasing them out, will you put the F-35s there?
Representative Sadler?
I think actually, although no one can play Pentagon politics exactly, I think if there currently is an A-10 squadron someplace, and they've got a mission, they've got equipment to fulfill it, I think the advantage of Eielson in Alaska is we've got a mission, but no equipment there. So I think we have a higher claim on new aircraft coming off the line than somebody who's already got A-10s flying.
Right, and through the chair, Co-Chair Ledoux, the A-10s were taken away from Eielson, which also their hangar spaces would need very little modification comparative to, say, other type of aircraft. The F-35 can fit into them with minimal modification is what we're being told and how we're representing it. So because they left Eielson, the replacement to the A-10, the F-35, would be a logical place to host it. But as far as the A-10s go, I believe the Air Force will be phasing them out of its entire inventory, and they'll probably be shipped off overseas someplace. So, but we can get you that information if you'd like, or perhaps Jim Dodson's on the line with Fedco, Fairbanks Economic Development Corporation, who also serves on the governor's ANFAS team, which is the advisory board to the governor regarding all things military, and on that team also are several generals. So if the chair would permit, maybe Jim Dodson, if he's available, could answer that question particularly.
Jim Dodson, are you on the line?
I am. Thank you. Mr. Chair, just to answer that question, the two squadrons of F-35s that are in discussion here are going to be an overseas, or what the military calls an OCONUS stationing, the Asia Pacific Theater, because that has been given the designation by the Department of Defense as the prime military area of interest. We're going to get the first two squadrons of F-35s. So you have to only consider those bases that are in the Asia Pacific Theater, and that includes the 9 installations that Representative Isaacson talked about. They are not considered a CONUS or a United States stationing. It is an overseas stationing.
Thank you.
Representative Sadler?
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hughes.
Yes, I had, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had the good pleasure of hearing on the, about the report from the Arctic Policy Commission today. And as we are venturing into a new frontier in that realm, eight nations involved, one of their focus areas has been regarding security. And I just read through the bill again to see if there was any mention of that, and I don't want to suggest an amendment because I don't want to slow it down. But I would suggest that if you have conversations or cover letters or anything like that that go forward with the resolution, that you mention that, because there is an international security aspect to that. We will see increased activity, and a lot of focus has been on the Asia-Pacific theater, but I think that there are going to be new things happening in the coming decades regarding the Arctic area, and that would also be a good reason why this location should be selected as opposed to somewhere else.
Good, the chair. Thank you. Representative Hughes will make that note.
And we've got a question with Representative Higgins.
More of a comment than a question, to a degree. You know, this summer we had the privilege of talking with the General Ed Eielson about this, and we were talking about how do bases get selected for these. And you know, they look at everything. And so far, you know, they look at economics, they look at the community, but what's really kind of important, I mean, we have the biggest air training space for these type of planes here. And we have you know, our energy costs are a little bit more expensive, but we're working on that, bringing that down. But I think the deciding factor is how bad do we want them? I mean, I think the state, you know, and the community needs to step up and say, we want them here. And that's what this resolution is about, is sending a statement to the Pentagon saying, we want these planes at Eielson. And that could be what's the deciding factor of pushing them over, because if they put it on paper, Eielson Air Force Base is the closest Pacific Rim base that can handle this kind of aircraft all the way around fairly easy. And so, you know, to me, it's a no-brainer. You don't want to go to foreign nations without bases, because they can close those down at any time they want. The training area that we have is surpassed to none. There's nobody, no state in the union has the training space that we have. So the next step is we just need to know that we want them. And that's what we're saying. We do want them. So I'll end with that.
Thank you, Representative Higgins. No further questions? Okay, seeing none, we'll go ahead and take public testimony, and we have a few folks online here. Jim Dodson, are you online?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Jim Dodson. I'm president of Fairbanks Economic Development and also a member of the governor's AmFast team. I managed the effort in 2005 for the governor of the state of Alaska and the mayor of Fairbanks Nescott Borough to retain the mission at Eielson. So I do have considerable experience in military issues. One of the things that we need to understand as we look at the military industry and the stationing of equipment and manpower in Alaska is that it is a competitive industry that other states, other communities are looking for an opportunity to get those men and equipment for the economic impact. When we look at the economic impact in Alaska, recognizing that the military industry is 16% of our gross state product and a total 17% of the payroll paid in the state of Alaska, we recognize that it is an industry that we should be cognizant of. We should support the sustainability and the growth of. And I would encourage the legislature through your Joint Ops Services Committee and through this committee to, you know, to be cognizant of that industry and help support and grow it. The F-35 station in Alaska is a new opportunity for Alaska. I won't repeat things that people already said on your committee, but they are absolutely right. I'd like to associate myself with their remarks. The airspace is second to none in the world. Alaska needs to learn how to leverage that airspace. Our strategic position in the world is second to none. Our 168th Air Tanker Group, stationed at Eielson with its 24 million gallons of fuel storage, is the northern fuel station top of the world for the United States Air Force. We need to learn how to leverage those opportunities. Supporting this resolution is the right thing to do for our state, our economy, and our nation, and I encourage you to support the resolution. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. We've also got two other folks on the line here. Mayor Luke Hopkins, are you online? Mayor Fairbanks.
Yes, I am. This is Mayor Luke Hopkins, Fairbanks, North Star Borough, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak on behalf of this resolution. All that's been said. So, through the chair and members of the committee, you know, we sit here at Eielson. We've been in an offensive mode, similar to our experiences in 05 BRAC, but not quite as dire, but with the F-16s, and we're well aware of the importance of Eielson Air Force Base in the strategic basing issue for F-35s. The commanders at Eielson Air Force Base show regularly a slide that says from the interior base here in Alaska, they can reach any place in the northern hemisphere in about 9 hours. There's such a strategic advantage, and that's exactly why the F-35s are being considered here, and why it's important for Alaska, both for our economy and for the efforts that the military has and partakes in with this Asia-Pacific realignment. So, you know, there's a discussion about F-22s, and the Air Force has made comment on that back in October, and of course, well aware of the discussions about A-10s, and that came up even in the National Defense Authorization Act of this year that was just signed. But coming back to this resolution, it is very important for both the state legislature and our local communities, as we have resolutions, to be sending them on to the commanders in the Air Force and Secretary of the Air Force. So I thank you for this joint resolution, and certainly hope that you pass this out even today, and I'll be glad to answer any questions that I can. But you know, again, thank you very much for bringing this forward.
Thank you, Mayor Hopkins. And then finally, we have Tim Jones with Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce. Tim, are you online?
I am. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Tim Jones. I'm a retired Army colonel, previous garrison commander at Fort Wainwright, current chairman of the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce Military Affairs Committee, and the interior representative to the state's Joint Armed Services Committee. I'm happy to be able to add my voice today in support of HJR 19. This basing action is not only beneficial to the community, which Jim Dodson and Mayor Hopkins have both articulated very well, but it is the right thing to do for the Air Force. Eielson's strategic location alone justifies the basing decision. It's positioned to rapidly respond to military requirements not only throughout the Pacific, but throughout Europe, Middle East, and Asia as well, as it's done both for the Army and the Air Force. But of course, as has been mentioned, that's not all that Eielson has going for it. The air-to-air and air-to-ground training through the Joint Pacific Alaska Range Complex, JPARC, is world-class. It is hard to beat now or in the future for the potential it offers. A co-location with the 168 air refueling wing, one of the Air Force's most strategically important wings, adds to that. A superior quality of life experience for service members and their families who are stationed here, as well as the tremendous support that the community and the state provides. This isn't news to any of you, and it is outlined much more eloquently in the language of the resolution, but I wanted to register my personal support and the support of the Chamber's Military Affairs Committee. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Tim. Do we have any questions from the committee of any of the folks who testified? Do we have any questions from the committee for the bill sponsor? Okay, with that, we'll go ahead and close public testimony. And I believe it looks like we have an amendment. Representative Greenberg, if you'd like to introduce your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move amendment number one.
I'm going to object for purposes of discussion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Co-chair. In discussing the bill with the sponsor last week and putting my name on it, too, I thought it would be a good idea to have something that indicates that Alaskans also support not just this one base and this one operation, but all Alaskan bases. And this seemed to be the place to go on line 13, where it says that Alaskans have proven their support of all military service members and all bases in Alaska, just so that people don't think we're limited to this one particular project. And I was very pleased. I understand that the representative from North Pole is willing to accept this as a friendly amendment, and in fact he has helped craft it, so it contains language from both of us. And with that, I would hope that objection could be removed after he indicates I haven't misstated his position, I hope.
Thank you, Representative Greenberg. Is there any discussion on the amendment? Representative Sadler?
Thank you, sir. Representative Greenberg, was it your desire for that to be on all bases in Alaska or and all bases in Alaska? Because you said and, but it says on.
Oh, probably and.
And?
I think that would be, I take that as a friendly amendment. And I'd ask the maker. You have to speak.
Oh, well, through the chair, Representative Greenberg, absolutely, and Representative Sadler, and all bases in Alaska is, I think, intentioned. Yes.
So for the record, I would ask unanimous consent that the amendment be amended accordingly.
Okay, and we could have a little bit of discussion here. Representative Hughes?
Yes, and thank you for that, because I was going to suggest that friendly amendment to the amendment, because we have Alaskans serving on bases in other places besides in the state, and I don't want to say that we only support the military members that are serving here in our state, but throughout the military bases. So that covers it, because we show support for the bases here in Alaska as well as all military members wherever they are serving. And so I like that. Thank you.
Representative Madu?
I like it also, but I'm also wondering, and I'm just throwing this out for consideration, whether we should also put it on page 3, line 14.
I would, if I may respond, if the representative were to give us some language, I'd be prepared to accept that as a friendly amendment.
I guess conceptually the language would read the same as your language, adding it all military service members and all bases in Alaska.
If that's a motion.
Is that friendly amendment, I believe?
Yeah, I'll make it in the form of a amendment to an amendment to an amendment.
It's just an amendment to the amendment.
Okay, an amendment to the amendment.
I would accept that as a friendly amendment with the agreement of the sponsor of the bill.
If that is the will of this body, that's fine. It might be a redundancy because it's already in the whereas prior stated, but if your purpose is to say, well, if we have continually in the past done it and now we salute currently, that's fine.
I don't have any ownership thing in this thing. It's the will of the committee.
Yes, I would respectfully just say it's whatever you would like to do to expressly state that. I don't think it's needed because we just stated it in the previous whereas, but if you want to really make sure that we get that point across, then by all means.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenberg?
I like the amendment to the amendment. I think it restates it. And it may be a chicken soup amendment, but it certainly doesn't do any harm. And I, if it's willing to be accepted, I appreciate the amendment and would like to accept it.
Is there any objection to the amendment? Hearing none, what is adopted. So then to the amendments, Representative Levy, do you still maintain your objection?
No, I'm removing my objection.
Okay, are there any further objections? Seeing no objections, the amendments, conceptual amendments is adopted. And so, let's see here. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to offer a second, very friendly, very small amendment. In the list of folks to whom this resolution would be addressed, I would propose adding Lieutenant General Russell Handy, who is a commander of the 11th Air Force and commander of J-Bear and has responsibilities across the state. Don't probably hear about it, but if we're sending it out, might as well send him a copy as well.
Through the chair, Rep. Satter. So, whoever this needs to be added conceptually, yeah, just as wide a distribution as this committee wants to make it, and you might just add that into all other parties essential to this placement. I know, but conceptually, that's what I'm saying.
I think for the purposes of this amendment, I would limit it to General Handy. Certainly, it'll get passed around, but I think for just this purpose, I'd like to add that, and I think the drafters can add that on next time, or we can adopt it here.
Sure. And for purpose of discussion, I will object to the amendment, conceptual amendment. Representative Grimberg?
To the maker of the amendment, do you also, through the chair, do you also want to send it to the members of our delegation?
Through the chair, I don't think so. I think this is a decision that the Pentagon, that the SECF is going to make, and so I think sending it quickly to the most important decision makers is probably the best thing, although I appreciate the sentiment.
Here, I'm going to lift my objection to the conceptual amendment. Are there any further objections? Seeing none, the conceptual amendment is adopted. Are there any further amendments? Okay, seeing none, is there any further discussion on the resolution itself? Seeing none, I will entertain a motion to pass out of Military and Veterans Affairs, HGR 19.
Okay. I move to pass out of Military and Veterans Affairs, HJR 19-28-LS1051/N as amended. With, I don't think there's any attached fiscal note.
Okay,
that's right.
Okay, are there any objections to the motion?
Just understand it's with attached zero fiscal note.
And amendment.
And as amended conceptually.
That's correct.
We probably have to do, through the chair, I'm not sure, I think we may have to do a zero committee fiscal note. I don't know.
There's no fiscal, it's not simply a zero fiscal note. There's no fiscal
note. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. No section.
Correct. Okay. Seeing no objections, the resolution is adopted. Thank you very much, and we'll take it at ease as we sign the folder. Thank you, everybody. Back to order. And next we have House Bill 212. Representative Isaacson will be presenting on that. And if you could just repeat again for the record yourself and your staff's name and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name for the record is Doug Isaacson, and I represent North Pole and Eielson. And I also have with me Nathan Salalio, who is my intern from ULA, a political science major. Excellent. So I'm also honored to be able to present this almost a companion bill for the action that you just took, in the sense that it is another affirmation of our friendliness to the military. Every year, hundreds of military members come to Alaska as part of their honorable service to our country. Many of these brave women, men and women are accompanied by their spouses. While they now live in Alaska, many of them would like to retain their address in their home state. By law, any new person that moves to Alaska must surrender their residence in another state in order to obtain an Alaska driver's license, and they've got to do that within 90 days of arriving. Exempted from this requirement are military members who are allowed to retain their home state license. But the spouse, who is here because of the member, is not exempted. Alaska is a military-friendly state, and we value not only our military members, but also their families. So it should be of great importance to Alaskans to make the military transition away from home as easy as possible while they provide a great service to our country. We would not be alone in the passage of this bill. As a matter of fact, we're behind the curve. 39 other states already exempt the military member and their spouses. I want to highlight the fact that this is an important bill when you think of just one of those kudos. But in your packet, you've got at least four emails from spouses who have said, man, this would be very helpful. So I won't read through them, but you'll see that Kathy Randolph has written. You'll see that Shannon and Dave Seavey have written, Tanya Kelly, and Kim Mahom. Now, what this bill is not, it is not a free driver's license. You have to have a driver's license in another state. What this is not, it is not giving the dependents the right to have a free driver's license. A dependent still has to go get their driver's license from a local DMV. When I tried to float the idea of having the dependents included, I had a lot of kickback because they're young, inexperienced drivers, and for many of them, Alaska is their first place of getting a license. So we just did it for the spouses. And so finally, what this is not a request to change the Constitution. This is not making a constitutional amendment to define what spouse means. It is saying whatever the state constitution and statutes define a spouse, that's what we'll honor. So this is, again, and for that there's a sectional analysis that talks about if the member spouse is 18 years of age or older, the spouse of a member of the armed forces of the United States who has a valid driver's license issued by another jurisdiction, and that's what we're talking about. So I'm not trying to make this into a battleground. The majority of the spouses are going to be people like, for example, a mom whose husband was deployed, three kids serving at Eielson Air Force Base, dead of winter, a stranger in a strange land. You know, a lot of what they do is on Eielson, and she has to go 35 miles into the DMV, and she has her three kids. Now, if she was a state resident, we would require you go and go to DMV and get your license. But she's here because she is supporting her spouse. And so her spouse didn't have to make this trek, but she does. So this is to help that scenario. It's to help, as Representative Thompson told me when he was mayor of Fairbanks, military member on Fort Wainwright, deployed. His spouse worked in a bank in Fairbanks. Because she was driving under the assumption that spouses were exempt, she didn't get her driver's license changed nor the tags on her vehicle. And so the state troopers see her, and 6 months have gone by. They want to impound the vehicle, and they want to arrest her. This is not the message that we're trying to tell our military members, come to Alaska and be manhandled. But again, if it's in statute, we're telling our public safety officers, enforce it. Because, you know, we're afraid that, you know, in a litigious society, if you don't do something, somebody else is going to sue you, or if someone gets hurt, and so forth. So we're just making it very clear in statute, following the lead of 39 other states, that if a spouse is here because of a military member, they're accorded the same privilege of the member. And with that, I'll ask for your full support.
Thank you, Representative Isaacson. We've got a question from Co-Chair Representative Ledoux.
Why 18? Do we give out driver's licenses here at 16, do we not?
Through the chair, yes.
So follow up. So why would a spouse who is 16 years old, who has a valid license in another state, why would that person not be subject to the same rule as somebody who's 18 years old?
Through the chair, if answered this in a technical way, could I ask if Amy Erickson, the director of DMV, is online? Could she answer this question more authoritatively, if you would?
Anybody who wants to answer the question, I'm happy with.
All right.
Amy Erickson, are you online?
I am online, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. If you could just state your name and affiliation for the record.
Yes, this is Amy Erickson, the Director of the Division of Motor Vehicles. To answer Representative Ledoux's question, a person 16 years of age would get a provisional license.
And can I follow up?
Follow up.
What's a provisional license?
It's a license that's issued to a 16-year-old, and they would hold the license until they're 18 when they get the required 40 hours by law to graduate to the next level of license.
So through the chair, if I may add to that. So on a provisional basis, then we're saying that the spouse has to have a fully certified driver's license from another state. And if Ms. Erickson wants to correct me on that. But this would be saying at 18, you've taken the provisional basis off of the license, and so we're according them the same privilege accepting another state's license in our state.
Follow-up? So, do other states have provisional licenses?
Through the chair, Amy, I'm not sure if they do, but if you could answer that question, you would know better than I would.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, other states do indeed have provisional licenses. Whether all of them do, I'm not certain.
Just one more follow-up. So, I mean, theoretically, how hard would it be to give the 16-year-old who has a provisional license in a state that has provisional licenses, why not just give her the same kind of license or let her drive under the same circumstances as she could drive in the other state?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, we would want to stay consistent with what Alaska driving laws are and not necessarily, because we don't necessarily know what the laws would be in other states.
Representative Hughes.
And right along that, maybe for clarification, and I don't know all the rules, but the provisional licenses, there are particular rules associated. For instance, they can't have a bunch of friends in the car, but they can... I believe, Amy, you can correct me, they can transport their siblings. There are very specific rules, and provisional licenses in other states might not have the same rules, so I would question whether it would be transferable in the way that you're thinking because of those associated rules.
And through the chair, if I may, the reason why we didn't do the dependent was these types of issues. We wanted to make sure that someone had a fully accredited, as it were, driver's license from another state that could transfer here. It's kind of like a doctor or a lawyer who might be able to have their licenses recognized in another state. We're doing the same thing. And so the cleanest, best way is to make sure that they are fully certified by their state and honor that license in this state, and then it removes all of the, well, you can if you can't, you know, it just is real clean, and that's, again, why we didn't do the dependents.
Just a follow-up. Actually, I wasn't thinking about a dependent. I mean, although it could be applied to a dependent, I'm actually thinking of a military spouse who is 16 years old, and while I understand where you're coming from on it, you know, you're talking about the stranger in the strange land who has to drive 35 miles in the dead of winter to get the driver's license, you know. So it's compounded probably when you're 16 or 17 years old. So I was just thinking if there was any way feasible to cover these folks, and there's probably relatively few of them, it would be nice to do so.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Co-Chair Ledoux, there is always the fact that whenever we make something that's a benefit for some, we won't make it a benefit for all, and trying to make it a benefit for all. But because there's, you know, always the law of diminishing returns, and I'm glad you highlight that, we won't be able to help everyone in every situation, but the vast majority of spouses will be helped by this. We won't be able to help all definitions of spouse, whether it might be a 16-year-old spouse or whether it might be a spouse recognized in another state in a homosexual relationship. In this state, we try to get as many as we can in equal protection, equal coverage. But so to make it as broad of applicability as possible, trying to give it the parameters that we did would say, okay, we need to make sure that you're fully certified, and most of the spouses will be in that position, and so this will give the greatest number of spouses the benefit of their member.
Thank you. I understand that.
Thank you very much.
Representative Hughes.
Yes, I just want to thank the sponsor for bringing this forward, because I have children who have and had served in the military, and daughter and daughter-in-law. And I will say that my daughter was under great stress when she moved to Germany, knowing that she had to get her driver's license. And there were things over there, one of them being the Autobahn, different things like that, that just added to the stress, and knowing that she had to take the test over there. So I can see where this this is the right thing for Alaska to do, and I do also see how it will also send a signal to the commanders that Alaska continues to be military friendly, and we're going to keep improving that. So I believe it's a good bill.
Representative Ledoux.
Echo those comments made by Representative Hughes, but now that Representative Isaacson has mentioned dependents, I'm seeing that all of these other states, back in the backup material, it says the same rule applies to family members. So have you considered making this available to dependents also who are over the age of 18 years old?
Thank you, through the chair. I did, but I got sufficient enough feedback that wasn't necessarily desirable in Arctic conditions necessarily, you know, that I was stretching it for the spouse. And so at this moment, I would like to at least prove the theory works, and I've talked to public safety, and they don't see a danger. I've talked to my municipal police, and they don't see a danger, but baby steps.
Okay.
Thank you.
Follow you.
Are there any further comments or questions by committee members?
Yes.
Representative Sander.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize if the question has been raised and answered, but has the question been raised with the permanent fund dividend folks about the effect of this on military members, or excuse me, military spouses, permanent funded dividend eligibility? Should they avail themselves of this opportunity?
Through the chair, and I believe Amy can also attest to this, but my conversations have been, she's online, my conversations have been that one of the proofs of residency is that you show intent to stay, and that is demonstrated by getting an Alaska driver's license. I do not see that if you could retain a driver's license from another state, you could pass the red face test that you intend to stay. And Ms. Erickson, if you'd like to comment on that.
Amy Erickson, are you there?
We've lost her.
We also have Ann Bartolo, who may be available for questions as well. May be able to answer this.
Did Amy say she was here? Okay.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler,
I do agree that it would make it more difficult to be eligible for the PSD, since the license is the sort of typical example of proving your residence. But I would defer to the PSD.
Okay, and Dan, if you could maybe come up and just state your name and affiliation for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Dan DiBartolo. I'm the director for the Permanent Fund Dividend Division. In answer to the question, what we have found historically, and I want to remember to be clear, this is highly situational. It all depends on an individual's residency situation. We have a military spouse, and their intent is to become a permanent resident of Alaska and receive the permanent fund dividend. One of the ties that we consider a very important tie is to register for and receive your Alaska driver's license. If they have the option to be exempt from that, and they're making the conscious choice not to receive Alaska driver's license, it will certainly make it more difficult for us to prove that someone's intent is to be an Alaskan for the purposes of receiving the permanent fund dividend. And it complicates it for the military spouse, where we already find that in those situations, often a primary residence is in the actual military member's name, maybe the automobiles, many possessions, and some of the very few ties we have for the spouse is the driver's license. And if that goes away, when you have to weigh the difference between whether or not they are more likely a resident out of state than not, the balance then tips in the favor of not, which means it would be the burden of proof would certainly increase on the military spouse.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I guess I appreciate that. And for the record, I just want to put a very fine point on it for military families. This may be a benefit, and it could be a tremendous benefit in certain circumstances, but it puts your permanent fund dividend at some risk. Beware.
Well, through the chair, Representative Sadler, again, this is a voluntary thing. And it wouldn't put at risk your PFD if your intention is to stay in the state. You are going to get an Alaska driver's license. Oftentimes, when I was in the military, I kept, until I decided to become an Alaska residency, I kept my Washington state residence, and I proved it in my military service with my Washington state driver's license, because my intent at that time was to return to Washington until I came to God's country, Alaska. So if someone, again, is volunteering to do this program, they have to recognize that what they're saying is that their home of record is not Alaska.
Thank you, Representative Hughes.
And related to this, and I don't know if Dan, you can tell me, or perhaps the bill's sponsor, is there any kind of orientation for military families that move here regarding whether related to the PFD and the things that they might want to be thinking about? And if so, is this should be something they should be educated about? And maybe we need somebody from the military to tell us that, but I was just thinking if this were to pass, I would hope that they would educate military members.
Representative Hughes, through the chair, I will say that one of our ongoing efforts with the Department of Revenue is to educate military specifically about permanent fund dividend issues, on top of that, even child support issues. Recently, I had been in contact with their division as well, and we've been making efforts to actually visit bases throughout the state when they are willing and ready to welcome us, and to share information about our programs and the actions that they take and how it can affect them. So we are actually stepping up our education efforts throughout the state, and if a change like this were to occur, we just want to make sure they knew what was going on.
Through the chair, we have former Garrison Commander Colonel Tim Jones, I believe, is still online, and he could tell you what training, at least at Fort Wainwright, was available on this, if you choose to ask.
Okay, if we could have maybe Tim Jones address that, and then we've got a question with Representative Nadine. Tim Jones, are you online?
I am.
Madam Chairman. Thank you. There is no formal training that I'm aware of that's targeted at that. However, it's understood among military members that the permanent, along with the permanent fund, comes, as Representative Isaacson indicated, a intent to remain in Alaska and be an Alaskan resident. So the general knowledge among the military is that if you want to request a permanent fund dividend, then you will become an Alaskan resident, and to do that, you'll get a military driver's license. So most of the folks that I have known, I'm sorry, I said military driver's license, I meant Alaska driver's license. Most of the folks I have known that intended to do that did cancel their previous state driver's license, change their state of residency, and become an Alaska resident and get an Alaskan driver's license. So I would expect the spouse would do the same thing. I would not expect that you would have a spouse and a service member that made different choices there.
So I see in our supporting documents this driver's license information page for active duty members. Who prepared that?
Through the chair, if I could ask my staff, Nathan, to who physically put this together, to actually address that, and if you'd like to put yourself on record.
Yes, through the chair, my name is Nathan Slova. I put that together.
Okay, so this isn't something that's just given out to military people when they come to the state, saying this is my home state, this et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You did this yourself.
Through the chair, yes, I went online and did my research on what the different laws for each state would be. And this is what I found correct.
Thank you. And could I follow up with the director of the Permanent Fund Division again?
And again, if you could just repeat your name.
For the record, my name is Dan DiBartolo, director for the Permanent Fund Dividend Division.
Mr. DiBartolo, correct? So, I could envision a situation where somebody comes into the state and they know about the permanent fund and they decide that they want to indicate that they are going to be staying in the state, and most people, I think, would indicate that by filling out a voter registration form. But at the same time, you're confronted with, oh, a military member doesn't have to, you know, get a new driver's license. And I actually, myself, and my background's a legal background, I didn't know that you couldn't fill out a voter registration form in one state and continue to have your driver's license from another state. So, can you?
Yeah, that wouldn't be him. That would be somebody else.
Okay, sorry.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, there are many situations that we face where someone has inconsistent actions, where they register to vote in one state, while having other ties to the state of Alaska at the same time. It's the inconsistent action that will always work against someone. And we look to gather all that information. It's not just whether or not they register to vote out of state or in state and where they have a driver's license, but we weigh all the information, including are you receiving some kind of other benefit, like a homestead exemption in another state? Are you claiming moving expenses from one location to another that doesn't involve Alaska. It's a myriad of factors that play into it, and you're talking about one situation, and we'd be looking at a much larger picture.
Do you ask on the permanent fund dividend form, do you have a driver's license in another state? Is that one of the things that gets asked?
We ask if you have ties to another state, not specifically if you have a driver's license in another state.
Thank you.
Representative Hughes?
And I suppose this would be for the bill sponsor. So you have someone, another situation, typically base assignments, at least in the Air Force, are often 3 years. If one were to be assigned this year to a base here in Alaska, they chose, this bill were to pass, they decided to keep their home state driver's license, and we have a presidential election. And my understanding is even when you're not registered to vote, if you can show you're an American, I believe you can vote in the presidential election. So would their home state driver's license with a photo ID, would that be allowed to be used to vote in Alaska? They wouldn't get the full ballot, but my understanding is they would be able to vote for president and vice president. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Representative Isaacson. So my understanding is you would get an absentee ballot from your state, or you could go and do a, ballot at any location with the appropriate proof. But the scenario you described, I believe, is accurate. But I don't have anyone from elections here.
We'll follow up, and I guess that would be an answer, something I would like to know, because if they haven't applied for an absentee and so they're showing up in person on election day, would the question ballot, would it end up being counted? I guess that's the question I would like to know, if they're using an out-of-state photo ID driver's license.
Through the chair, Rep. Hughes, we can find that information for you. How it pertains to this bill, it will be really not even affected by this bill, because that currently is the case for hundreds of people who are in-state on election day with out-of-state driver's license and out-of-state voting ability. So that is handled by individuals currently and Division of Election. This would not be changing that scenario. All this is doing is allowing an individual who wants to retain their home of record elsewhere. And they're here because the military has brought their military member spouse to Alaska. And so they have kept the family intact, and they have accompanied their spouse. This allows them the same ability to retain their home of record as their member spouse. Or conversely, if they want to become Alaska resident and their spouse doesn't, they're still free. Even as the member, they're free individually to get an Alaska driver's license within 90 days of coming here, or at that point where they decide they want to remain Alaskan residents, even if they might have a few more different bases that they would be PCS to or whatever.
Mr. Chairman?
Hello?
We support our military, and the active duty members have this, and this would allow the spouses as well. And I would just hope that in Alaska that our military could vote for their commander-in-chief and their vote be counted.
Through the chair, that does happen currently, I can assure you, on our bases in Alaska.
Representative Greenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've digressed a bit from the bill, but I think it may be the case of the tail wagging the dog a bit, and we've been going down a road that I think is important. If we can have a little leeway for a few more questions on this.
Sure, Representative.
I'm talking from the shoes of a young military family, just as an example. They'd like to get the PFD, but there may be certain things they can do or can't do that might dramatically affect their legal ability to do that. Does the state government in any way, either by paper or online, provide a way of advising people of the consequences of potential things they might do. For example, a website that would say, if you want to get a permanent fund dividend and are considering certain actions, check them here and we'll tell you what the consequences might be. Taking advantage of this law now, you know, keeping your Nebraska license and stuff. So they could get advice before they take what may be a legally determinative, maybe outcome determinative action that may have terrific financial ramifications for them and potentially family members, kids and stuff. Does the state provide any place that these people who are not lawyers, not particularly educated, not particularly mature, can find out the answer before they take an action that can take thousands of dollars away from the family?
Representative Gruenberg, through the chair, the speaking on behalf of the Permanent Fund Dividend and the Department of Revenue, we use our website as an information portal currently regarding the most complicated eligibility decisions and choices that you could make regarding eligibility. A individual certainly would have to seek out that information and the cause and effect relationship that you were speaking to. I do not have a mechanism like that on our website currently. We have been working on more military outreach, creating a new form called the Military Information Form. When someone declares a military absence, we would actually send that form out explaining what are some of the things they need to look out for and how far back they need to retain their records. Because with the passage of a law last year, HB 52, that is now a clear-cut line for anyone. You must remain in Alaska 30 days over 5 years in order to get your PFD, even with allowable absences. And that can hit the military the hardest if they're not aware of that situation. And so we are doing our best in outreach, but we are just beginning that process. So as far as the technological side, we have options on our website. It would have to be built.
Through the chair, I'm not on state affairs. I note that the sponsor of the bill is on state affairs. And I don't know if there's anybody else here on this committee who's on state affairs, but that's directly within the purview of that committee where I served for a long time. And I wish I was still on it, frankly. I would recommend that somebody, and I'm happy to help, you know, from where I am, consider whether we should have some legislation with an appropriate fiscal note directing whoever to have something that it clearly informs people of what they might do that may affect their, in this case, eligibility for a permanent fund. Because otherwise, they're going to get themselves, some people in terrific problems. I have a friend who's an administrative law judge and sits on these cases. And some of them go up to the Supreme Court. They're so complicated. And if we simply provided information, maybe the kind of thing that they could, on their computer, say, if you do this, then you could do this, and then you could track what they're going to do, and then they could find out right there before they make the application for a driver's license or something. That would probably deny your right to a PFD. That may then determine what they do. That's certainly worth looking into.
Through the chair, Representative Greenberg, I've written that down, and I will see about how we could craft that, and you have a division director here who's heard that loud and clear, and he might be able to just enact that without legislation.
I'll be happy to work with you and to follow your lead. Please put me down as a volunteer to help you with the legislation or whatever, gentlemen. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any further questions of the committee? Okay, with that, Representative Sutter?
I do apologize. I've got a question for Amy Erickson with DMV, if I could. Ms. Erickson, if you can hear me, in the background information provided with this bill, there's a note about the different driver's license provisions for different states. In Alaska, it says in the first page of the driver's license information for active duty members, it says that, yes, a valid home state license is honored for active duty military until 90 days. days after discharge. And it said, until 90 days after discharge, that's the focus of my question. I could not find in state statute where that 90-day expiration exists. And my question would go to, would this legislation also require a military spouse's exemption from Alaska licensing requirements to expire 90 days after the military spouse's deactivation or discharge? That was one sentence. She couldn't hear me.
We lost her.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative Sather, I believe that is for a military member who's out of state.
Okay. You know what section of statute that's in?
And through the chair, you have a sectional analysis that describes where this is taken. And I believe the intent, and Amy could correct me, but as you mentioned, it's out of state. Or if you're staying in state and decide not to leave, you're basically becoming a de facto Alaskan. You're no longer in the military. Okay. And so state law requires that if you're here from another state longer than 90 days, you have to get an Alaska driver's license.
That makes sense. That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, both of you.
Okay, thank you. Are there further questions? Okay, with that, we'll open up public testimony, and we have three people online who would like to testify. We're with Tim Jones with the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce first. Tim Jones, are you there? And if you are, if you could just state your name and affiliation for the record.
I am. My name is Tim Jones, retired Army Colonel, previous garrison commander at Fort Wainwright, and current chairman of the Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce's Military Affairs Committee. Thanks for the opportunity to speak in support of House Bill 212. I think this type of legislation is long overdue. Soldier Sailors Relief Act has provided this protection for active duty military, but has been pointed out the spouses haven't received that coverage. I was in the Army for 27 years. I was, for most of that time, a Tennessee resident, and I maintained a Tennessee driver's license until I became a resident of Alaska after I moved up here and we decided we would retire here. My wife, on the other hand, has been licensed in Alabama, California, Tennessee, Kansas, Tennessee again, Pennsylvania, and North Carolina before getting her final Alaska license here. I'll point out now there's been concern about spouses or service members potentially losing PFD money. In my experience, service members don't come here with the expectation that they will receive the permanent fund. There's an act, it's an act of commission they have to commit. They have to show intent. Intent becoming being defined as becoming a resident of the state. It's understood in the military you can only be a resident of one state, although I will tell you I have seen a number of different actions from folks that are trying to get around state income tax or other things, vehicle tags and so on, but our legal services in all services are pretty thorough with their service members, identifying that you can only be a member of a state. You will pay the income taxes that are due to that state if you're that resident. You'll purchase your automobile tags, vehicle tags, and driver's license and so on in that state. So it's not really been an issue for the service member. It's been an issue primarily for the spouse. Honestly, the folks that I think are going to want the PFD, they're going to become members of the state. They're going to become state citizens. And to do that, they should have to get a state driver's license. So if they elect to remain residents of their current state, then they shouldn't be due the PFD, in my opinion. But I do think this step goes a long way in showing our military families that the sacrifices that they make in service to our nation are appreciated by the people and the leaders of our state. And
That concludes my comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Tim Jones. Next up, we have Erwin Johansson. If you're there, if you could just state your name and affiliation for the record.
Yes, Chairman, I'm here. And we have one concern from the departmental law. If you'd like to avoid possible constitutional challenge.
I'm sorry, Erwin, and your affiliation is your?
Assistant Attorney General.
Okay, thank you.
It would be wise to accommodate same-sex couples in the bill, same-sex domestic partners. We have a couple of cases from 2005 and 2011 that the spousal exemption was subject to an equal protection challenge, and that's my comment.
Okay, thank you. Next up, we have Jim Dodson. Jim, if you're there, if you could just state your name and affiliation for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Jim Dodson, President of Fairbanks Economic Development Corporation. I'm here today to speak on behalf of this bill and urge the committee's support for House Bill 212. It is showing the service member and the service member's spouse the right appreciation, the true appreciation that Alaska and Alaskans feel for military, and thank you for their military service. Please join Representative Isaacson and support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. Okay, is there anybody in the room who would like to testify, or anybody else online who would like to testify on HB 212? Hearing and seeing none, we'll go ahead and close public testimony. And do we have any further questions of the committee? Representative Sadler?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Not a question, I guess, but a statement. I'm proud to serve the legislature in a state that is so welcoming to its service members. And while we welcome those who are transferred to Alaska to become Alaskans if they so desire and enjoy the benefits of living in God's country, as Representative Isaacson has said, if for any reason they decide not to become Alaskans, I think this is evidence of our desire to extend a welcoming hand to lower the burden of their service and life in Alaska. And I think it's evidence of our good nature and welcome to them even if they don't become Alaskans. I support the bill.
Thank you, Representative Sadler. Any further comments or questions? Seeing none, we do have a member who would like to introduce an amendment, and we'll be preparing that. So we'll be holding the bill over until our next meeting. Representative Greenberg, do you have a comment?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Everybody knows what I've said. And I appreciated I stepped out and talked to my staff for a minute. There may be a way of avoiding an amendment. And I appreciate the ability to have a little time to think if there's another solution to the problem. And if you forced the issue today, I would have no choice but to offer the amendment. It may well be that we can avoid this altogether. And I'll say no more, but I have no desire to rag a bill around, particularly this one, to embarrass members of the committee on this or any other subject. And let me see what I can do.
Any further comments? Okay, well, seeing none, we'll go ahead and adjourn the...
I would just say one thing, if I may. Sure. If we could have some warning as to when this bill is coming up again, that would help me. I understand it will not come up on Thursday.
That's correct. We currently don't have a meeting scheduled on Thursday, but I'll work with Co-Chair and Ledoux, and we'll figure out a date, and then we'll let you know.
Thank you. That would be greatly appreciated.
Okay. Well, with that, the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs Committee is hereby adjourned at 2:50. Thank you very much, everybody.